100 years after this relay to save the children of Nome, and Leonard Sepla, Togo, Balto, who was also owned by Leonard Sepla, and Leonard Sepla's team being instrumental, you know, doing by far the most to save the children of Nome, 100 years after that, there are about 100 Sepulas left in the world. At the time when I made the decision to do this, I had 12, which is not enough to run an Iditarod or an expedition on. Just building up the team fast enough for a 2025 run at anything was a tall order. And we went into the 2024-2025 training season with 22 dogs, 22 Sepulas. So out of those 100 Sepulas in the world, 22 of them were in my yard.
That is Jonathan Hayes. We are kicking off a special series on his Centennial Sepula Expedition. This is episode one. Let's kick it off.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Jonathan, thank you for joining us today. This is episode one of our podcast series. How's it going?
It's great. I'm honored to be here. Thank you, Robert.
We are sitting here in, is it Bangor or Bangor? What is it?
The local maniacs love to make fun of people for calling it Bangor, but that's more fun to say. It's Bangor.
And for folks that may or may not know, this is the home of Stephen King. Does he still live here?
He does, yeah. Actually, he was a public school teacher here in Maine, and kept writing books on the side until he made it as famous as he is.
Excellent. Well, we hope to make you more famous than you are up here in Maine. We're going to talk about your expedition, and we're going to jump way into that. We have a whole podcast series about that. But today's episode is all about the lead up. And I know this was a multi-year deal. I remember talking to you 3 or 4 years ago, just kind of right around COVID time. We were talking about the lead up to this expedition, but we're not going to go that far back. But what was the genesis of this whole thing? Can you give us a quick story about that?
Yeah, we were going through COVID, and everyone was, you know, doing the COVID thing. And Poland Spring Resort, the owner of Poland Spring Resort, Cindy Robbins, is a very good friend of mine. And few people know that Leonard Sepla moved and he established his first Sepla kennels at Poland Spring here in Poland Spring, Maine. And at the resort in 1927. So she wanted to make a statue to Togo, because Togo lived out the rest of his life in Poland Spring. So she wanted to erect a monument to Togo there. And she said, so I'm going to do some fundraisers. And it was January. And I said, like, all the races had been canceled because of COVID. I said, how about I do an expedition, you know, to raise money for it? And she goes, when? And I said, well, you know, best conditions here in Maine are going to be in 2 weeks. So I hastily threw together a solo expedition. Our friend Jeremy Grant came and chronicled it. And his film, True North, is on YouTube. And so I did that. And I really was just doing it as a fundraiser for, you know, for the Togo Monument. And after I did it, started having sponsors reach out to me, and you know, for the viewing of the film, I would go and there'd be reporters there, and I'd get the same question every time. And the question was, "What's next?" And man, what is next? And then I realized 2025 is the 100-year anniversary, and so I need to do something on that. And so there was this tug of war. Back and forth between trying to run the Iditarod. You and I spoke a lot because you had done a commemorative run of the serum run before. And so, you know, you had, you know, helped me out a lot by brainstorming with a lot of that. And, so, I was just back and forth trying to decide which of the two I would do. And as, we talked about in, a previous podcast, me blowing out my knee right before a 300 mile Iditarod qualifier in Alaska kind of made the decision for me at that point.
So let's back up just a hair, Jonathan. So the main expedition was what year?
I think it was 2021. It was during COVID.
Okay.
And so it was just a couple of years before I went up to Alaska with Mitch Seavey and training his teams for Iditarod qualifiers.
So 2021 was that expedition in Maine. That led up to thinking about doing a...
Something in 2025.
Something about doing either Iditarod or a different expedition a couple of years later. We're going to jump all into this about your dog lineage and all of that. But it was important to you. This goes right into the next question in terms of inspiration. It was important to you to use a particular dog. So the question is what inspired you to undertake the Centennial Sepala Expedition?
My dogs inspired me to do this. 100 years after this relay to save the children of Nome, and Leonard Sepala Togo Balto, who was also owned by Leonard Sepala, and Leonard Sepala's team being instrumental, you know, doing by far the most to save the children of Nome. 100 years after that, there are about 100 Sepalas left in the world. And at the time when I made the decision to do this, I had 12, which is not enough to run an Iditarod or an expedition on. And so just building up the team fast enough for a 2025 run at anything was a tall order. And we went into the 2024-2025 training season with 22 dogs, 22 Sepalas. So out of those 100 Sepalas in the world, 22 of them were in my yard this winter. And, you know, I'm currently serving as the president of the breed club. And, you know, as a breed steward, like having that torch handed off to me and, you know, and then being able to, you know, to carry them into the 21st century as a distinct breed, you know, and thank God for the Continental Kennel Club, because without them recognizing this as a distinct breed, they would have been absorbed and reassimilated back into the Siberian Husky pool, and we wouldn't have them anymore.
So, guys, hearing all this stuff, we have all sorts of episodes on everything that Jonathan talked about. We interviewed the president of the Continental Kennel Club a couple of years ago. We've interviewed Jonathan a few years ago. So if this is wetting your whistle, as they say, definitely check out our back catalog. So, Jonathan, can you describe the significance of retracing the original serum run route, the lead up to that?
For me, it's significant not only, again, you know, I don't believe in chance. I believe in providence. And here we are. Here I am with a kennel of Leonard Sepala's dogs on the 100-year anniversary, and I'm the same age as Leonard Sepala did when Leonard Sepala did it. And so, you know, all of these things just lining up. And really, sadly, I think there were only two Sepala kennels that were capable of fielding a team. Mine and probably Deer Creek would have been able to have done it, too. They've got a good team of Sepalas out there. But, I mean, just by virtue of size of a kennel. Retracing that with Leonard Sepala's dogs on the 100-year anniversary. As you know, there have been several reenactments of the serum run, and that's why it was important to us not only to do it on the 100-year anniversary, but to do it on the exact date, you know, January 27th, which became a real bugger. You know, there's a lot of really good sound logic and reason why people do it later in the season and why the Iditarod is run in March, as we discovered.
So this is literally a once-in-a-lifetime deal. Not only the lead-up to that, the money, all of that, But we only get a 100-year anniversary one time in our lifetime on anything, right? Especially if we can live that long. So how much did that play into that? I know we talked about Iditarod and all of that. Why was that so important, that 100-year anniversary?
You know, and again, our mutual friend Jeremy said, an Iditarod can be run any year, right? And rightfully so, you know, but, you know, a 100-year centennial run can only be run once every 100 years, and you've got Leonard Zeppelin's dogs. And so I really felt like this was my calling. It was my destiny to do this at this time in my life.
Okay. So this is a dog question, so we're going to switch a little bit here. How does the training process for this expedition differ from standard dog sled races?
Well, as you know, even training for dog sled races varies depending on whether you're doing short, mid, or long distance training. But for me, it was weight heavy, you know, that kind of weight, not waiting. Heavy pulling for prolonged periods of time at a steady pace, marching pace, just under a trot, just under a lope, just where. So find where the team breaks into a lope, pull them back from that, and then try to build them up to where they can do that, pulling significant amounts of weight in less than desirable trail conditions.
Speaking of which, a quick aside, Jonathan, all of your training was done in Maine?
Yeah, and there are a lot of things, and I know we'll get into this later, there are a lot of things that we can train for that Alaska is going to throw at us. There's a lot of things we can train for here in Maine and replicate here in Maine. Overflow, drum ice, deep snow. You know, we get as deep as snow as many portions of Alaska and northernmost Maine. One thing, and we'll get into this later, one thing I could not prepare for here in Maine, I mean, we even hit 40 below, you know, a couple times a winter or so. One thing I couldn't prepare for here, though, was the polished ice and gale force winds of the coast.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew going into this, whenever an interviewer asked me, you know, what scares you most, what are you most concerned about, I would always say the coast, because I knew that better mushers than me and better dog teams than me had been shut down on that coast in the Iditarod, and we were going to be doing it in February.
Right. So, leadership question here. What qualities do you believe are essential for effective leadership in the outdoor setting? And put your team leader, expedition leader hat on for this. I know you were the man to do that. So what do you think about qualities for outdoor leaders?
Qualities for outdoor leaders, you have to balance. In my book, Mush, I hate acronyms because you wonder what came first, the acronym or the inspiration. But I did use an acronym, I used Mush as an acronym in my book that I wrote years ago. I need to rewrite it, but you need to be mission-minded, Mush, the M. You need to be mission-minded, but you need to balance that with the S, which is, you know, servant leadership, servanthood. You've got to balance those two things. And I'm a little more on the mission side than, you know, and so you have to intentionally. Some people are very, very much, nurturing, to the detriment of mission. And other people are very mission-minded to the detriment of nurturing the team. And as anybody who's done distance mushing knows, there has to be that balance. You cannot reach your goals if you're not nurturing your team and caring for them.
And you come from a military background. You also come from a very church-oriented background, two different sides of the coin there, if you will. Did you find you putting the servant leader hat on more, or more of that authoritarian military style?
Yeah, and it is two sides of the same coin, because ultimately, as authoritative as military leaders can be, in the military, this is actually in the Marine Corps, this is actually what they taught you. Number one is mission accomplishment. Number two is troop welfare. So number one is mission accomplishment. Number two is troop welfare, and in that order. But that being said, you can't accomplish a mission without taking care of the welfare of your troops. And of course, from the other side of that coin, as you just pointed out, that dichotomy, you know, my Christian, you know, I've studied theology in college and grew up in it, in the Bible Belt in the South. And that aspect is very much servant leadership, you know, oriented. It's very much you lead by serving, you lead by sacrificing yourself for the team. So I do think they do go hand in hand.
So, Jonathan, you have not made it to the starting line yet, but there was quite a bit of buildup to this. Mm-hmm. What did you do to motivate and inspire your team during challenging conditions, and in particular, that crazy drive that you guys did, leaving in the middle of winter, driving all pretty much as far away as you can go from one end of North America to the other,
yeah,
in some God forsaken speed. How did you motivate everybody leading up to this starting line?
Thankfully, a lot of that has to do with choosing the right team members. You've got to choose people for the team that have that kind of drive that thrives a little bit on adversity. You know, we were supposed to be at a potlatch in Nenana to celebrate the 100-year anniversary with the community. We were the guests of honor, and we were stuck in an avalanche for 14 hours, you know. So, and, you know, just some people, you know, that would get them down, but, you know, the type of team I put together just added to the excitement, added to the intensity. So a lot of motivating your team starts with choosing the right team and having people who like a little bit of a challenge and a little bit of adversity rather than get dissuaded by it.
So a side question here, let's name drop a little bit. Who were the members of your team? Who was boots on the ground, the people that are going with you, and who helped you out kind of behind the scenes?
So behind the scenes, I'll start there. We could not, obviously, if I put a price tag on this expedition, which I did at the beginning, you know, if I had to go out and just spend the money, you know, not in-kind sponsorships, just if I had to go out and spend the money, this was over $90,000. So, you know, we had native performance dog food, Continental Kennel Club, Poland Spring Resort, Poland Spring Water. We had some really good sponsors that came behind us. Cultro, you know, I could go on and on naming the sponsors. I'm just so grateful to them behind the scenes. But boots on the ground, Jamie Nichols was kind of my second in command, my chief engineer. If he can't fix it, it can't be fixed. You know, he once fixed a transmission that went out on a snowmobile in the backcountry with a piece of cardboard. Like, the guy just knows what he's doing, you know, and rugged and, you know, really stubborn-minded, kind of like I am. And so he was kind of like, and I told the team, if I'm not around, Jamie's in charge. And, you know, I told everyone my way of setting up this team was everyone had their sphere of authority. I was reserving veto power, but Jamie had his sphere of authority, Caleb had his sphere of authority, Jeff had his, and so within their sphere, you know, they got to call the shots, and I just reserved veto authority, you know, if I felt like, as the person looking at the big picture instead of looking at the small things, if I felt like that decision wasn't for the good of the entire team, and I only had to exercise that veto power a couple times on the expedition. For the most part, everyone respected the gifts and strengths of each other, and you know, respected the authority that came to that. So it was Jamie Nichols, and then our videographer, Caleb Gingras from Quebec. He's phenomenal, just very gifted artist, and has become a friend. And then Jeff Kelly, who came on in a support role to the Snow Machiners, but within 4 or 5 days, we found out that he was very dog-oriented, and the dogs responded to him really well. And so he kind of became my handler as well, just naturally was drawn to the dogs. The dogs are naturally drawn to him. So a really great, great team. A decent guy can be a great leader if he's confident enough to surround himself with greatness. A lot of times you have leaders who are too insecure to surround themselves with great people. But if you can have just enough confidence, like Jamie knows way more than I would ever pretend to know in his field. And the same with Caleb, and the same with Jeff. And so not feeling intimidated by that and allowing them to come and shine on this team and do what they're capable of bringing, and giving them the respect in that realm, is what made it work.
And that is probably the answer to the next question. But before we go there, obviously you could not have done this without significant others, your wives. I know that your wife was instrumental in that, in quote-unquote allowing you to go.
Yeah.
Right? All of us have that in the mushing world, is our partner has to say yes. I know that, I believe it was Jamie's, I assume his wife was instrumental in keeping the updates on the social media during your trip. But we would be remiss without mentioning the dogs as team members.
Yeah.
You said that you had a pool of 22 going into this. How many dogs did you take with you? And did they all finish, or did you have to drop any of them?
Yeah, so we were training 22 dogs for two 10-dog teams. And then when one of the other expedition team members, for financial reasons and personal family reasons, felt like he needed to withdraw from the expedition, I had 20 teams. I had 20 dogs that had earned the right to be on this expedition, and only one musher. So I could find another musher, or I could just build this super dream team. And so I did. We took 16 dogs on this expedition, and this is something we might want to get into later, but I do want to brag on these guys. Of course they'd be blown away by the speed of a Nick Petit team, or the endurance of, and speed of, a Dallas EV team, or something of that nature. But the rugged winter hardiness of a traditional Arctic Spitz breed of working dog, I had always believed it intellectually, but I experienced it on this trail. We brought around 1,000 dog booties. I think I used 16 dog booties over the course of 20 days. I started with 16 dogs. We finished with 16 dogs. And as the reporters in Nome that are used to seeing dog teams cross the finish line noted the following day in their interviews, my dogs were ready to go. They were ready to keep going. They were just, to them, Nome was just another stop along the way, and they wanted to pull another 60-miler the next day. They were starting to put on weight. I'll just say this, and then I'll leave it for now, because I know we're going to get into this later. My dogs had never run in gale force conditions on glare ice. And teams sometimes shut down on that. But I saw in a moment when we were first hit with that, I saw a transformation where even the dogs that were running 60-70% of themselves for most of the expedition, for two-thirds of the expedition, 100% of 100% of the dogs just locked in. And here I am just, trying to keep from allowing the sled to flip over. And I'm like, Jonathan, shut up. Don't say a word. This is beautiful. This is magic that you're witnessing right now. Just shut up. Stand back here. Be quiet and just watch. And I just watched in awe. Whenever we hit those really, really hard times, it's like my team was a bunch of adrenaline junkies. And they're like, heck yeah, let's do this. Let's go. And I'm like, seriously? And I'm like, okay, yeah, I am the weakest link on this team for sure.
Right. Yeah. Last question here in this first episode of this series. How did you ensure the well-being of both your team and your dogs leading up to this? What was the thought process about this is how me as the expedition leader are going to take care of people, even though they could take care of themselves,
yeah,
right? How did you think about that leading up to this?
We pulled, I'll answer that by telling you this. We pulled into Nome with over half of our human food supplies and a third of our dog supplies. And it's because I overdid it in the expedition planning. You know, when humans are out there, they eat a lot more. Dogs eat a lot more. You know, I used a lot of Iditarod formulas. I'm a high school teacher and middle school teacher, and we do an Iditarod module every year. And my biology students have to calculate caloric intake and you know, the burn and, you know, how many calories are in beaver, how many calories in this, and, you know, what combination are they going to provide for their mushroom. So I do this every year. So, like, you know, my mind's already thinking about all this stuff year after year. But my strategy for taking care of the team, now for the short answer, was dogs and humans, was to make every allowance. I spent $2,000 on dog coats. My dogs didn't need them. In fact, there were, you know, at the moment where some teams would have needed them the most, and we'll get into this when we talk about the blowhole, in conditions where some teams would have needed those coats the most, I discovered that those coats were more of a detriment to my dogs than a help in that situation.
All right. So to close this first episode, Jonathan, where can folks find out more about you?
Check us out at Mushmane on Instagram, on Facebook, and Cultro out of the UK. Richard Bailey's designed a beautiful website for us. It's mushmane.com.
There you go. All right, guys, be sure to tune in next time and make sure you hit that subscribe button so you'll never miss one of these episodes. This is going to be a very fun series talking about Jonathan Hayes's expedition through Alaska, paying homage to the 1925 Serum Run. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Got a dog training problem? There's a podcast for that to stay updated on everything dogs do on Dog Works Radio, a podcast hosted by master dog trainers and business coaches Robert and Michelle Forto. Every week, they will introduce you to pet professionals with unique insights on dogs in the veterinary world, in books and films, and working with canines. The podcast also answers questions like how long does it take to train a puppy, or what are the different training styles? Get some surprising answers on Dog Works Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts. Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.